Hi, welcome to Neuroverse, a podcast hosted by Carolina
and Clara, where we discuss all matters from neuroscience to philosophy and beyond.
So today's episode is on reading and writing patterns in the brain, and we are joined by Dr. Adil Khan to discuss two-photon microscopy and optogenetics for studying the role of neural activity in behavior. This episode is also the third episode in our mini-series, Tools for Looking into the Brain, in our collaboration with Scientifica. So Dr. Adil Khan is a group leader and senior lecturer at King's College London. He completed his PhD in India at the National Center for Biological Sciences, and then went on to do a postdoc with Tom Sick-Flogel at UCL and the University of Basel before starting his own lab here at King's College London. His lab currently focuses on the neural circuit mechanisms that underlie flexible behavior in mice, particularly on the interactions between the sensory cortex, prefrontal cortex, and the striatum, and how these contribute to attentional modulation of behavior and task switching. To study these cognitive phenomena, his lab uses a variety of methodological tools, which we'll be discussing today, namely chronic in vivo two-photon calcium imaging of neurons, targeted optogenetic manipulations, viral vector-based circuit mapping, and quantitative mouse behavioral assays. Thank you so much for joining us today, Adil.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you on. So why don't we begin the episode, as we normally do with guests, just by asking, what made you interested in neuroscience and how did you end up studying behavioral and neural circuits?
Wow, that's a great question. So I actually was determined to become an environmental activist when I was an undergrad, which is why I studied chemistry for my undergraduate.
Ah.
And but while I was studying chemistry, I actually, I guess I was exposed to some neuroscientific questions because of a few colleagues I had at the time of visiting some neuroscience labs around Delhi where I was doing my my undergrad. And that was a very quick transition at that point. I think I very soon understood that there were two questions that I realized were very deeply fascinating to me. One was the question of the origin of life, and the second was the question of the brain and how it works. And it was immediately obvious that the question of the origin of life, deeply enigmatic as it is going to be much, much harder to experimentally answer. And and at the same time, the question of neurosciences becomes more and more exciting the more you think about it, because it's so personal. You're really thinking about thinking. And so, yeah, it very quickly became absolutely, you know, fascinated by the question, went to do my PhD at the National Center for Biological Sciences, where I really sort of took the first serious plunge into it and haven't looked back.
Amazing. I love how you weren't able to escape neuroscience, even though you were set to do chemistry.
Yeah.
It's too compelling.
I think chemistry gives an excellent of a basis for neuroscience. I think that...
I agree.
Yeah.
So how did you transition then from kind of chemistry at such a small scale to the larger scale of neuroscience, which is neural circuit systems and then behavior?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I guess the link from chemistry to neuroscience is not really a direct one. I think it's more at the level of just the training of the way you think about structure-function relationships, for example, and just, you know, the basic sort of styles of thinking about problems. But once I entered neuroscience, I think the question about circuits came later. I think the first question, which became interesting to me, was the question of behavior. It is like, okay, that's the most the immediately attractive thing to understand is how is complex intelligent behavior produced. And then when you start to think about complex intelligent behavior, of course, you have to, as a number of people have written about very elegantly, that the only way to understand it is to understand it at multiple scales, starting from molecules, all the way, you know, talking about the sodium channels and potassium channels and NMDA receptors, all the way from molecules going up subcellular compartments, to neurons, to circuits of neurons, to interacting regions across the brain. And this really sort of cross-scale view of things was immediately became like obvious that you really need to understand that. And then, of course, you have to make your choice where you want to slot in there. I think I found this question, the sort of scale of neural circuits, to be a particularly appealing one. I think it lies somewhere in between the two extremes of interacting brain regions versus molecules, and I think that's probably been one of the regions which has had some probably very interesting breakthroughs recently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can definitely relate to the struggle of having to choose your level, and as I'm still like contemplating that in my journey, and also like finding a kind of in between in the neural circuit territory.
Yeah, yeah. And if you're lucky, you get to straddle a few levels at least. I mean, I think our lab right now is actually trying to do that, sort of straddle at least 3 or 4 levels of this, from molecules to circuits to brain-wide interactions. Yeah,
mm-hmm. I do think that's amazing. And coming from a biochemistry background, I can also relate in like wanting to tie in the two levels of the molecular to the behavioral, and really finding the mechanism of how everything slots in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And you also mentioned how recently, with the tools that we're developing, we're able to look at the role of neural circuits more. So your lab uses 2-photon calcium imaging a lot. We've briefly discussed this in our previous episode on fluorescence microscopy, but could you tell us a bit about how this works and what the advantages of using 2-photon microscopy is, to answer the questions?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll start off with the second half, which is the advantage. So I think it's sort of, you can put the thing into context if you imagine what is one of the big challenges that we face as neuroscientists when we try to record from the activity of the brain. And early sort of breakthroughs, like I'm thinking of Hubel and Wiesel, etc., is that you can put an electrode into the brain, record from one or a few neurons at a time, and you get these astonishing insights that Hubel and Wiesel got, that individual neurons are tuned to specific features of the world, etc., etc., and you can get them from neurons tuned to the orientation of a line, or they can be tuned to the, you know, you have the Jennifer Aniston cell, which is neurons which are tuned to the concept of a person, etc. But that's insights at the level of single neurons or maybe a handful of neurons. And one thing which was obvious to anyone studying the brain for a while, but had always been a problem, was that the brain is fundamentally a parallel computing machine. There are neurons computing things in parallel and interacting as they do so. And to really understand it, it's not enough to record from one or a few neurons at a time. You really want to start recording from many neurons simultaneously. And so technologically, there was always this challenge. What could you do? You could maybe put in many, many electrodes simultaneously. So that, but you can push that up to a point. And people have done that. People have got some fascinating results from that. A parallel sort of approach to solve this problem was with imaging. So how about we essentially, in the very first pass, focus a camera on the brain. And that gives you an image, or let's say, of the brain's surface. And that already, you know, there's a lot of classic studies looking at not just mice, but, you know, brains of salamanders and stuff like that to get the activity of, and because of the nature of an image is that you're imaging multiple things simultaneously. And if that plane of that you're imaging happens to have a handful of neurons, you might get the activity of multiple neurons simultaneously. But this approach hits this fundamental roadblock, which is that when you're imaging something like a brain, which is thick and highly scattering, and it's full of neurons stacked on top of each other, it's going to be very, very difficult to use any imaging technique to be able to say, okay, I'm imaging this neuron and not the other. Because neurons above and below are going to contribute to your image. It's all going to get mushed into each other. The image is going to be any signal you're getting, any one pixel in your image, let's say, that you're getting, is going to be a mix of signals from many, many neurons. So this was the sort of one of the problems that we really needed to solve to be able to use imaging as a tool to break this barrier of recording from many neurons simultaneously. And so this is where, and even though it's a bit of a mouthful, in vivo 2-photon calcium imaging, it's actually, if you break it down, it's really an elegant and very simple approach. And what it did was to essentially break this barrier of being able to image from neurons without mixing up signals from above and below them, and imaging in tissue intrinsically scattering and not ideal for light to pass through as the brain. And so that was basically the background why suddenly 2-photon imaging has become such a popular approach to imaging activity. It allows us to image things in parallel, multiple neurons in parallel. And if you want to, we can get into the technical wizardry sort of behind this. Should we get into that right away?
I think so.
So I think, so it starts off with something discovered in the 1930s by Maria Goeppert-Mayer. And it's essentially a discovery in quantum mechanics. and you guys said you discussed fluorescence microscopy in your previous episode, and fluorescence microscopy essentially can be simply described as light falls on a molecule, an electron goes from a ground state to a ray state, and then falls back down, and when it falls back down to its ground state, it emits a photon. And that's really the basis, that's what you need to keep happening over and over again, and that sort of the slight difference in the incoming and outgoing light allows us to have fluorescence microscopy. And so that was used for a while, but what Maria Goeppert-Mayer discovered was that, well, she actually didn't show this experimentally, she made a theoretical prediction that it's possible for, instead of one photon hitting the electron going up and the electron coming down, it might be possible for two photons to simultaneously hit this electron, the electron jump up, in a set, as if it had been hit by one photon of twice the energy,
mm-hmm.
right? So essentially you can have two photons of half the energy each, and if you can make them hit quickly enough, they might combine almost as if it was one. And it does this by passing through this intermediate sort of state. Now, this was experimentally shown, I think sometime in the 60s, but it was really in the 90s that this was turned into a microscope. Now, what is the big deal about this two photons coming in simultaneously? Well, normally, if you think of the way a microscope, which was specifically a laser scanning microscope, the job is that you focus a beam of light into a pinpoint and you scan the pinpoint across a sample, right? Normally, when you do that, which is what we do in confocal microscopes, light is coming through down as a cone, focusing down to a pinpoint, but points above and below the pinpoint, the focal point, they are actually still, molecules there are still hanging, fluorescent molecules are still hanging around there. They are also getting excited, not as strongly as at the focus, because the focus by definition where everything's been focused, but things a bit above and a bit below are also getting excited.
Mm-hmm.
And so you again have this problem of neurons above and below your neuron of interest are going to start contributing to your signal, everything's going to get mixed up. Confocal microscopy tries to solve this, well, does solve this problem using one approach, but what two-photon microscopy does, because these two photons need to converge to have the two-photon effect happen, the reason it's called nonlinear microscopy or nonlinear optics really is because normally as the intensity of the light goes down, the amount of fluorescence goes down linearly, which is why as you're going away from the focal point in a normal microscope, you're getting gradually fading away the intensity of the light. But with two-photon microscopy, it actually goes with the square of the intensity. And this small difference makes the world of a difference. Because it's going with the square, the moment you take a small step away from the focus, you have no two-photon effect at all. And what that means is that above and below the focal point, nothing is happening as far as we are concerned with fluorescence. And so this causes this almost magical images, which you can see some of them if you Google for this, that you've got a tube of fluorescent material, and on the one side you have a normal sort of one photon, as you can call it, one photon, light getting focused to a point, and you see the streak of light, and it gets focused, and it gets and it sort of, you see it coming in and you see it going out. And you have the same thing with two-photon microscopy, and you don't see any light coming in. At the pinpoint of the focus, you see the fluorescence happening, and further away from it, it stops happening again. It's almost as if the light has only exists at that pinpoint, hovering in space.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the really one of the key amazing things of two-photon microscopy, that you can create a pinpoint which has nothing above or below it causing fluorescence and move that around in three-dimensional space. There is a second thing which makes this really useful for actually imaging in live brains, which is that, because remember what we mentioned was that the two photons which hit almost simultaneously, they have half the energy each.
Mm-hmm.
Having half the energy each means they have longer wavelength. And longer wavelength, by its very nature, scatters less. If you think of like, the reason why we can listen to a radio today inside our house is because radio waves have very long, so long they can pass through walls, right? So the longer your wavelength, the less it gets interferes with material. It can pass through material almost, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And because two-photon microscopy inherently means it's half the energy, which means longer wavelength light is being used, longer wavelength light penetrates much better into any scattering tissue, particularly the brain. So whereas you'll be limited to 100, 200 microns at best with the confocal microscopy, with the normal one photon light, with two photon light, you're using infrared light, much longer wavelength, and that can just go very, very deep into the brain. And that suddenly allows you to access deeper regions of the brain and without the light getting scattered. And again, because it's this one pinpoint which is being created, you're moving that around and you can just sort of scan over a few neurons and nothing above or below it is going to interfere. All the photons that are emitted at that point will only be photons of interest, so you can, because there is no other source of fluorescence other than your pinpoint. So the collection of any photon means every photon you can just collect it and you know it's photon of your interest. So this really is what makes two-photon microscopy a marvel, that the ability to image deep into tissue that normally light doesn't like to pass through, but because you're using longer wavelengths of light, it can pass through quite well. It actually, there's also a subtlety, which is that there's a lot of these molecules inside all biological tissue, proteins, melanin kind of, you know, molecules, essentially most proteins, which just really interfere with light at different wavelengths. And if you look at a spectrum, this is a famous image which you can find online again, that if you look at the different wavelengths of light and how much things are blocked by biological material, there's a lot of blockage happening at one end of the spectrum, a lot of blockage happening at the other, and there's a window of opportunity where neither water nor biological material really interacts very strongly. And that window of opportunity is exactly the wavelengths which two-photon microscopy works best in. So all of these things sort of come together to give you deep images and in living tissue without needing to, you know, brains which are alive. So this is, I think what really was what two-photon microscopy did. The ability to look at many, many neurons simultaneously, because now you're imaging, you can image a large area, you can suddenly see many, many neurons, and you can be sure that the image you're getting is not mixed up with noise from other parts of the brain.
Amazing. Yeah, I think it's amazing. I love the mechanism. It's seemingly simple, but it achieves such a big effect. I was thinking about how surely then if we just add photons, it'll be even better and even better. But then you said the thing about the ends of the spectrum not being... So is two photon optimal or with three
this
photon
This is an excellent
optimal?
Question. So there was a question which I was asking in a lecture recently about exactly this, that, well, why not 4 or 5 or 10 photon?
Yeah.
I think it's exactly that. So it's a really good point you raised. Three photon is actually a form of microscopy. There's three photon microscopy. And as you would predict, three photon microscopy, you can go even deeper.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's even less scattering. If you go further than that, then you actually start, the wavelengths get so long that you start to actually, it's basically water itself becomes a problem. Water starts to absorb at those wavelengths. And so again, the tissue essentially becomes practically opaque for when the wavelength gets too long.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really about the fact that there's a window of opportunity. If it had not been for that, then yes, you could have gone as high as you want. And of course, honestly, it becomes practically, I think, impossible soon, because you're talking about collecting enough light intensity at the focal point for the two-photon effect to happen.
Yeah.
You need even more light intensity for the three-photon effect to happen.
Right.
And for the three-photon effect to happen, you're already kind of pushing it, such that you often hear stories about damage due to the three-photon microscopy because of heat.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm pretty sure even a 4-photon microscopy was not obstructed by the water problem or by the problem that it's not, the window of opportunity closes. I think practically it would probably, I mean, I'm not an expert in laser engineering, so don't quote me on this, but I think it would have become practically also rather difficult to get enough light power in to cause a 4-photon effect.
Yeah.
But actually, shockingly, 3-photon microscopy does work, and it was actually in the 90s again, it was already shown. So interesting, the first paper which did that showed that serotonin naturally, the molecule serotonin naturally absorbs very well in the three-photon sort of regime. So they imaged in vivo serotonin just to show that you could do that with three-photon microscopy. But today, three-photon microscopy is used and you can do crazy stuff like image all the way through the cortex without damaging the cortex. It's imaged all the way through the cortex into the hippocampus.
Amazing.
So like a millimeter deep or something.
Yeah.
In mice, of course, yeah.
Yeah. That's really amazing, and you've described the whole process really beautifully. But as with all techniques, there are also their shortcomings, and I'm aware that time resolution is one of them, especially when it comes to things like three-photon microscopy. Could you explain a little bit some of the challenges with time?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there's also the other side of this, which is what are you imaging? Okay, one is the technique on which the light is shining and you're hitting your sample, and the other is what are you imaging? And so to answer the timing question, I'll probably go to this fluorophore first, because the fluorophore does put a limit on here.
Mm.
So with the fluorophore, this was actually one of the reasons why two-photon microscopy really has exploded onto the scene. It's continuing to become, you know, really extremely popular approach. It's because it's happened in combination with these amazing advances in the fluorophore. And what I'm specifically talking about is genetically encoded fluorophores which report activity of some sort or the other. The most popular one being genetically encoded indicators of calcium, because it happens, it so turns out that calcium is an excellent proxy for neural spiking. And since spiking is believed to be sort of the currency of the brain, the language in which neurons are talking to each other to a large extent, of course there's a lot of other things going on, but to a large extent, spiking is very important, and calcium is a very useful proxy. And what people developed were these extremely amazing dyes, which are bright whenever there's high calcium and are dark whenever there's low calcium. So it just shines bright, the neurons shine bright whenever they're spiking. So one of the most popular ones called GCAM, for example. On the other hand, there are other reporters of other things. For example, you have fluorescent indicators for dopamine, for I think acetylcholine, and a number of other neuromodulators, etc. So it was the development of these, and the important thing is that these are genetically encoded now. So you don't have to even inject anything into the brain if you don't really want to. So you can express this transgenically. You can also express them using injections of viruses, etc. But you can get enough of these things into the neurons, and they will stay in the neurons for weeks, even months. Whereas like a normal injection of something like, you know, an inorganic dye, it would get into the neurons, hang around for a while, and then get, you know, washed away. So you wouldn't have the opportunity to look at the same neuron for too long. Mm-hmm. But now these things are expressing in the neurons for the rest of the life of the animal, as far as we know. And that is, these two things together was what really makes it so powerful. Now these dyes themselves have a time sort of issue that you can't, that, well, first of all, the fact that calcium is what we're using as a proxy. Mm-hmm. So calcium itself is every time there's a spike, there'll be a little burst of calcium, but it's going to be, if there are two spikes very close to each other, there'll be two bumps of calcium merging into each other if the spikes are too close to each other. So it's almost, so calcium itself is putting a limit. On top of that, the dye is actually has a limit that, again, the same thing, if you have two spikes very close to each other, there'll be two bumps of the dye, and they're going to merge into each other because there's a sort of a slow fall off. Every time the dye gets bright, it as soon as the calcium goes away, it doesn't immediately shut off. Mm-hmm. So these sort of limitations of the dye cause a limit to your ability to image fast. And then on the other hand, you have the problem of imaging. Yes, of course, you can't scan across a sample arbitrarily fast. You can actually reduce the size of the sample. You won't, if you go to a large sample, you can't, but if you can reduce the size of the area of a sample, or if you reduce to just scanning, for example, one line, just over one neuron, for example, you can get to kilohertz rate. So you can really scan fast if you really wanted to. I think the problem with the time is more from the side of the sensors.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. This leads me on to a question that I have in relation to your research. So I read this paper about the disinhibition of VIP interneurons being orthogonal to attention in the visual cortex, and you used two photon imaging, and you were imaging four different cell classes, and whilst also simultaneously optogenetically activating these cells. Can you talk us through the challenges of these type of techniques and how you were able to achieve this type of imaging whilst also optogenetically activating?
Yeah, absolutely. And I should say this was the work done by Dylan Myers-Joseph in the lab, who was an extremely talented PhD student who's now doing his postdoc in Belgium. Yes, so the question we were going to address there was that we know that there are parts in the brain, specifically the visual parts, the parts of the brain which process visual features, which get more activated when we pay attention and less activated when we don't pay attention. This has been a finding for decades, and it's one of the most tantalizing insights into how the brain actually does things cognitively. Cognition is like an umbrella term. Attention is one part of cognition that we are so intimately familiar with. We do it all the time, pay attention, not pay attention. And then this neural correlate of attention has been known for a while, that neurons are sort of more alert to what's happening out in the visual world when you're paying attention. They're more selective to visual features when you're paying attention, and they kind of slack off when you're not paying attention. So that's been known, but now the neural circuits which allow this to happen have just basically been pretty much obscure. It's not been easy to study this. And one of the reasons has been that most of those findings have happened in monkeys or humans, and it's not possible to really apply the advanced sort of neural circuit tools to monkeys and humans.
Of course.
So one of the challenges was to get a mouse to do an attention switching task, which we did. Once the mouse is doing an attention switching task, we then use this two-photon microscopy to image the activity of neurons. And then first thing we established is, yes, in mice as well, you find this effect. Neurons are more switched on, showing enhanced responses when the mouse is paying attention, and they slack off when the mouse is not paying attention. They're showing less selective responses. So that was a sort of a starting point, that we've got the ability to record from neurons in the mouse brain and show these modulations by attention. this was the point at which sort of you could say, okay, other people had shown this, but here's where we came in and say, okay, but now we would like to test some very specific hypotheses. And the most popular sort of idea around the most sort of likely hypothesis, which was around of how this is happening, is that there is one specific type of inhibitory neuron whose job is to remove inhibition from the circuit. So it actually inhibits another inhibitory neuron, which is called disinhibition, which is a really interesting property in the brain. The ability not just to inhibit someone, but to inhibit another inhibitor to remove inhibition. So the brain clearly has a number of tricks up its sleeve. Now, this neuron which does disinhibition, there was a strong reason to believe that these neurons were the ones allowing these neurons to become more enhanced. And so when they are more active, these neurons, the neurons which are sending the output from the visual area are more enhanced because these neurons are more active. Now to really test this, what you need to do is to, while the animal is doing an attention switching task, attending, ignoring, then go in and switch on these neurons or switch off these neurons. Mm-hmm. And now this is where this sort of the second sort of theme of what we wanted to discuss today comes in, which is optogenetics. And optogenetics briefly is an approach in which you can use light to switch on or switch off neurons. And the way you do it is because you use these molecules which were actually discovered in algae in the oceans, mm-hmm. which these single cellular organisms used that to guide themselves to move towards the light and stuff like that. And when people took those molecules, put them into neurons, it turned out that amazingly you shine light on them and they are actually ion channels, so pumps, and they could actually cause depolarization or hyperpolarization. You can switch on or switch off neurons with light. So this has caused nothing short of a revolution in neuroscience, the ability to control the activity of neurons with light. The new thing which we did, in this context, of course, other people have done it in other contexts, was to simultaneously combine the imaging of activity with the optogenetics.
Yeah.
And you can imagine a sort of problem there, which is that you're using light for reading activity, and you're using light for playing in activity. And of course, there's going to be plenty of ways in which these two signals are going to interact. The light that you shine is going to also get into your detectors, which you're trying to read the activity. And so are you really reading the artifact of what you're shining or not? So a lot of sort of the challenges were to solve these problems. And we did this by some very clever, sort of very fast temporal deinterleaving, that when the light from the imaging is on, we don't switch on the light for the optogenetics. And when the light for the optogenetics is on, we switch off the light for the imaging. But this is happening in ridiculously fast time. Like, we're talking about like a few microseconds you use to switch on the light, then you switch to the other. So you go back and forth basically between the two.
Yeah.
And if you do it fast enough, it basically works out quite well. And then the really interesting finding was actually that the hypothesis was actually completely not true. We found that these neurons had absolutely no role to play in attention, even though every time we triggered those neurons with light, the brain was strongly modulated. Every time we made the mouse switch attention, the brain was strongly modulated. But if you do those two things together, they have no interaction with each other. It's as if the brain has the ability to do one thing and do the other thing. And if you ask it to do two things simultaneously, it can do the two things simultaneously, and those two things do not interact with each other. Which really shows how versatile the brain is in able to actually multiplex
mm-hmm.
two computations simultaneously.
So these interneurons were the VIP interneurons.
Yes.
How are you able to decouple this? How are you able to untangle the fact that even though if you stimulate it separately, the brain is doing that, but then if you put them together, how are you able to conclude that actually it's not the VIP interneurons that are leading to this increase in attention?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. So there are two levels of doing it. One was if you completely shut off these neurons,
mm-hmm.
and then you ask, with these neurons completely shut off optogenetically, if these neurons were involved in the attention process, you should have seen a deficit in the attention modulation in the neurons, which normally, like, so you compare the situation where you don't trouble the system, you let it do it what it does naturally, you make that measurement, and then you do the same measurement, but this time completely take, really strongly silencing these VIPs.
Mm.
What we found was that the normal attention modulation was unaffected.
Okay.
So that was one thing. On the other hand, what we did was to say, well, if we switch on these neurons,
mm-hmm.
can you induce something similar looking to what what attention naturally does?
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out you get something very similar in amplitude, but if you think of the neurons as trying to make the brain go into one state, and these states we like to think of them, imagine it's sort of a three-dimensional space in which the brain, when it's attending, goes to the top left corner, when it's not attending, it's in the bottom right corner, like let's say in a box. instead of this three-dimensional space, the brain actually works in a high-dimensional space. And what we found was that on the one hand, attention likes to go into the top left corner, VIP goes into the bottom right corner instead.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really moving the brain activity into two different parts of this high-dimensional space. That's really what it was, that they were moving orthogonally to each other if you think of them in the high-dimensional space. So not only is it not needed, because that we test by switching off the neurons, by switching on the neurons, you can drive a lot of activity, but those activity patterns are orthogonal to what happens naturally when you pay attention.
Yeah. And are these activity patterns, is there any behavioral readout for the difference in these activity patterns?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Other people have done a number of other things about what are the behavioral consequences of activating these neurons or the other. And in our case, the behavioral consequences was actually inbuilt into the experiment, which is that we know that when the animal is paying attention,
mm-hmm.
it is doing better at detecting a stimulus, telling us whether it was stimulus A or stimulus B.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of one of the things we were manipulating in the experiment. Forcing the animal, well, not forcing, but essentially training the animal to pay attention, and then in the other condition, training the animal to not pay attention. The attention was already, the behavioral consequence was actually inbuilt into the experiment already. But the implications are that in the future, when you want to now, let's say there's an animal which is unable, or some system which is unable to pay attention as it should, in that scenario, the goal is now to try and help that system achieve its full potential of paying attention, not paying attention, and switching between those two states. What we now know is that VIP interneurons are not the route to go.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, what we also know is that if you wanted to have an animal switch attention, but at the same time wanted to do something else while, and not affect attention, VIP interneurons suddenly present themselves as this very unique and useful opportunity that they are orthogonal to attention. So you will not be affecting an animal's ability to pay attention or not pay attention, so you could actually start to do something else. And what could that something else be? I don't know. That's for the future to say. But you could basically, it provides this opportunity of the brain being so diverse that you could actually do multiple computations using this finding.
I don't know if I just missed this, but did you just image VIP neuron activity on its own during this attentional modulation?
Yeah, great questions. Actually, what Carolina had mentioned in the introduction to this paper is actually, no, we had measured simultaneously four different classes of neurons. So three interneurons and the excitatory neurons. So not only did we measure the activity of VIP neurons, we also measured PV,
mm-hmm.
somatostatin, which is another type of inhibitory interneuron, and pyramidal neurons, which are the sort of workhorse, the majority, which are sending the outputs to the rest of the brain.
Okay.
So we're actually looking at these four cell types simultaneously,
yeah.
which was another trick which we applied, which I won't go into because it'll be too much of a digression, but measuring things simultaneously, again, coming back to this original question about measuring things one at a time gives you some insight, but it's really when you measure things simultaneously that you can ask questions about correlations
mm-hmm.
and how information is being processed in this parallel way. And that's one of the nice things about this study, that we parallelly measured simultaneously multiple cell classes.
Did you use like several different opsin wavelengths or something?
No, it's okay. So since you're asking, I'll go into it anyway. It's basically, the trick is that when you're imaging, you don't know which is which.
Uh-huh.
At the end of the experiment, you take the brain out and you slice it and you stain it for different cell markers, markers for different cell types. And then the challenge is, in these brains which have been taken out and sliced, and then you've got the images from the original days of the experiment, you need to find exactly the same neurons and match them and say, aha, here was a PV neuron, where is that in the original acquired data? And so you have to do a 3D image registration to match neuron to neuron, these two volumes that you have. And that way you can get, and actually so you can take, so this is, we don't know it up to four, but you can take this idea and take it up to as many as you want. And that is actually one of the things that's happening. There's a few labs which have done this. Some done up to 20 cell
mm-hmm.
types. Some of them actually have used this same approach and actually do identify like 50 or 100 different cell types post hoc. So it's the idea is that you do the imaging. At the time of imaging, you don't know what's what, but you take the brain out and then you process it and you can use sequencing approaches as well. Not just,
mm-hmm.
you know, what we used immunohistochemistry, you can use approaches for sequencing,
mm-hmm.
RNA sequencing in situ and sort of identify cell classes and then match them cell by cell back.
And so the G camp is expressed in all cells.
All cells.
Okay, it's not just
excitatory.
Exactly. Okay.
Yeah, that's the trick. So you express it everywhere. So that at the time of imaging, you have no idea what's what, but the post hoc, you identify them.
Fascinating. Fascinating. Yeah. I have one more follow-up question. If it's not VIP into neurons, do you have any possible candidate neurons that you think are the ones that are driving
this
attention?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So we actually have, that's one of the parts of the paper, which we do a theoretical model and we predict that PV into neurons are actually the ones doing this job. And actually, before Dylan left, he did some of these experiments, and it does look really, really fascinating.
Cool.
Which is strange, because VIP interneurons should influence the activity of PV. So the fact that you're altering their activity and it's not having an effect suggests...
So this was one of the interesting findings, and one of our collaborators from Imperial College and University of Bern, they did a theoretical model, and they asked exactly this question. The question was, how is it even possible to have such a strong, you're sort of hitting the brain with a hammer almost when you switch on VIPs.
Mm-hmm.
How can it be that you make such a strong perturbation and it leaves all of this untouched, this attention modulation untouched? And what they did was to search for all the parameters through all the parameter space and ask what circuit architecture would allow these two things to coexist. Attention modulation on the one hand, VIP modulation on the other hand, and the two not interact. And they basically provided this circuit architecture, which is one of the outputs of the paper. And then, of course, the next thing is to experimentally test whether that is indeed happening. And that's actually a really, when we started to do these tests, it turns out that, yes, it does look like PV into neurons are the ones really strongly involved in attention, but in a very weird way.
Okay.
I could go into this, but it goes off into a bit of a digression.
I don't mind.
So normally you would imagine, and this is actually one of the benefits of this amazing combination of combining imaging with optogenetics and simultaneously doing the two. Normally, you activate an inhibitory neuron, you expect the cells around it to get inhibited, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happens almost all the time. Same thing happened with us when we started to activate PV into neurons. We would see, okay, we switch on, and again, because we're doing this simultaneously, we can switch on and see the effect of that switching on PV into neurons on the neighboring cells, which are mostly excitatory cells. So we saw that most of the time, but then this really bizarre thing started popping up, which is that when the mice were engaged in something that was slightly more cognitively advanced, such as attention switching task, then by activating PV into neurons, we started to see that the neighboring excitatory neurons, instead of being inhibited, were getting activated. And this is something which has theoretically been sort of suggested to be possible. The theoretical sort of basis for this is that the network acts in the form of an inhibition-stabilized network. So if you look at the literature of inhibition-stabilized networks, the idea is that there is a small regime of a moderate amount of perturbation of a PV interneuron. And of course, in the theory, it's not PV, it's just excitatory and inhibitory. But there's a moderate amount that you can perturb it, which causes this paradoxical effect that by activating a PV, you activate the pyramidals. By inhibiting the PV, you inhibit the pyramidals. And you can sort of think of it as if you inhibit a PV, let's say, you are activating transiently the pyramidals around it. Because the pyramidals themselves are giving inputs to other PVs, they end up activating all these other PVs. And then because the other PVs have gotten activated, they pull everyone down again. So it's almost like a loop. Because it's such an interconnected loop, you can have paradoxical effects.
So do you think if we didn't use imaging and we use something with super high temporal resolution, you would see the initial excitation before the inhibition?
Absolutely. So that's the prediction, that you would be able to actually see this transient up and down. But although I think there is a study which claims to have shown this paradoxical effect already, and so we knew that this was possible. They showed in the other way. They showed by inhibiting PVs, they showed an inhibition of pyramidals.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm not mistaken, that was with electrophysiology. I don't think they saw this transient up and down. I think it happens so fast, you might not even be able to... Yeah, it's a good question. I'm not sure if it's going to be experimentally possible or what the conditions are to really see it.
This was only seen when mice were undergoing a complex...
No. So this was seen in a random mouse doing nothing, right?
Oh, okay.
What we have seen,
yes,
which takes it even a step further, is that the paradoxical effect can happen dependent on the cognitive state of the mouse, which completely blew me away. Because people have predicted the paradoxical effect. Some groups, very tentatively, I would say, experimental evidence is mounting up for it. But nowhere did anyone expect that the paradoxical effect itself can depend on what the cognitive state of the mouse's mind is. So that's what we seem to be seeing, that when we perturb PVs, you get these weird effects, paradoxical effects, only when the mouse is engaged in the attention switching. And through the paradoxical effect, you do get this effect that when you perturb PVs, you mess up your attention switching. But it's not in the way you'd expect. It's not because PVs just inhibit things, and that's why the circuit is not acting as it should. It's because PVs are inducing this weird paradoxical effect, and that paradoxical effect of activation rather than inhibition of your neighboring neurons is messing up your attention modulation. So, and this kind of stuff only can be really revealed when you're doing simultaneously measuring and perturbing. And that's sort of coming back to our theme of reading and writing.
Mm. Amazing.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
And could you tell us a bit about how the optogenetic stimulation alongside the two photon imaging can be at different scales as well? Because at the moment you're talking about targeting a specific subclass of cells, like all the VIP interneurons or all the PV interneurons across the window, and then also imaging activity in that window. But can you tell us a bit about how this can be varied as well?
Absolutely. So like you said, it's a really good point that at this, all of these experiments I described, they involve shining light from, let's say, an optical fiber or something, just broadly over a window in which there are a few thousand cells. And any neuron that is expressing the opsin will get activated or inhibited. But now, what you're raising this really tantalizing possibility. Is it going to be possible? Like, we know that when the brain is acting naturally, cells don't simultaneously switch on or switch off. Sometimes they do, but a lot of times they come on and off in a specific sequence, in a specific pattern. Cell 1, then 2, then 3, then 4, and then next time around it might be cell 3, then 2, then 1. So there's a particular pattern, and these patterns almost certainly must mean something. I mean, there's a reason why my neural activity happens, you know, in a certain pattern. So while recording neural activity has allowed us to observe these patterns, and we know now for sure that whenever the mouse thinks of blah, 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 it's this sequence is what's typically activated. Wouldn't it be amazing if you could play in that pattern, but actually at the level of individual neurons? Can I switch on neuron 1, and then neuron 5, and then neuron 3, and then neuron 7 in that sequence with that specific millisecond level precision? Mm-hmm. So this is really now, I would say, becoming a reality, and in some cases has become pretty effectively a practical reality. And the magic here is combining once again the amazing ability of two photon, sort of nonlinear optics, combining that with optogenetics. Mm-hmm. And once again, it's the ability of the two photon effect that it can travel through a tissue, and because it's to do with the square of the light intensity and the fact that it's nonlinear. When we're talking about imaging, the two photon fluorescence doesn't happen all the way while the light is reaching the focus. It only happens at the focus and not above or below it. In the same way, you can think of the optogenetic effect, that if there is an opsin molecule which needs wavelength, which needs light of a certain wavelength for it to get activated, let's say for the channel to open, instead of using single photon light, you can again do the same trick of use twice the wavelength or half the energy photons, but this time give them two in quick succession, and that will cause the channel to open instead. But this time again, because it's a two photon effect, as the light is traveling through the tissue, it's not going to activate any of the opsin molecules because the wavelength is too long and it's not enough light to cause the two photon effect, but only at the focal point is there enough intensity of light to cause the two photon effect. So you're effectively created an approach to have the opsins essentially get activated only at the focal point, not above, not below it. So this is in the simple scenario of just having a light coming down into a focal pinpoint. Now, once you've got this pinpoint, you can spiral that pinpoint around the cell and make it only that cell active, and a cell just above it or just below it will not get activated. You can move that pinpoint around, jump from one cell to another and activate cell 1, then cell 2, then cell 3, then cell 4. So that's the simpler approach of two-photon optogenetics allowing you to play in patterns. Now you can go even a step further than this. And rather than just having one pinpoint of light, you can use slightly more advanced optical techniques, in this case using this gadget called a spatial light modulator. The details are not important. The important thing is what it allows you to do is, instead of creating a single pinpoint and moving it around, you can create multiple little beamlets, you can say. So multiple points arbitrarily placed in three dimensions inside your tissue. And so you can simultaneously hit, let's say, 10 or 30 neurons. you can play in patterns into them, or you can play these five now and then these six later and then these five again and those 20 later. So you can play in activity into groups of neurons. You can change the spatial pattern that you're playing in. You can change it from one moment to the really, really quite fast with millisecond resolution. Change the pattern you're playing. So literally almost like, you know, playing a piano, you could just like play in patterns into a tissue. And you could even think of experiments where you're, while you're simultaneously reading the activity, and you're like, okay, so the brain is trying to go into this state. Let me play in this pattern to bring it into the other state instead. What does that do to the mouse's behavior?
Mm-hmm.
So this is kind of closed loop approaches of reading activity,
mm-hmm.
playing back activity, closed loop online, and then trying to discover what these neural circuits are trying to do, and can we perturb them? By perturbing them, can we understand what they naturally end up trying, what they naturally do to create behavior?
That's so cool.
Yeah, I'm completely sold.
Yeah. Is this something that you're using in your lab?
Yeah, absolutely. So the simpler approach, which is to be able to pinpoint, to take a pinpoint and spiral that around a few cells and jump around, is something which we are using.
Simple.
Silly. That's the simpler version. Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
So that's something which we're using now. And we are actually in the process of building the second version,
mm-hmm.
which is the SLM approach, which you can then just really go for many more neurons and truly simultaneously activate tens of neurons
mm-hmm.
within the tissue and then play in patterns.
And for context, could you tell us a bit about what the purpose of this is? Like, what is the project?
Yeah, so one of the questions is this paradoxical effect I talked to you about? What I mentioned was that by activating PVs, instead of seeing inhibition of your neighboring cells, sometimes you get a paradoxical excitation.
Mm-hmm.
Will this be true if I activate one PV cell?
Mm-hmm.
Will it be maybe not? Will it be true if I activate two? Or maybe three or four or five. So you
mm-hmm.
can actually then start to do the experiment of individually activating one cell, or then two or three or four or five, actually increasing the number of neurons that you activate. And you can't do that unless you are being able to activate individual neurons. So that's one question, right? And then the other question is, will that need the cells to be clustered together spatially? And then you start to see this paradoxical effect nearby.
Mm-hmm.
If I spread these PVs, which I'm manipulating too far apart, will I stop seeing that? What is the distance that they stop combining together to create this paradoxical effect? So that is one question which I think right away we can start to address.
Yeah, that's really interesting and good to see how it's specifically useful for like answering
mm-hmm.
questions such as this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And then of course what we're hoping to do is to then combine that with behavior
yeah.
and ask, now when the animal is doing cognitively something more engaging,
mm-hmm.
I start to see this paradoxical effect. I switch the mouse to doing something cognitively less engaging, I'm not seeing the paradoxical effect. But now, can I actually induce a paradoxical effect where it wasn't happening otherwise, or can I stop it happening where it was happening otherwise? In other words, and by doing so, does that eventually have an effect on behavior? Is this paradoxical thing actually something that the brain is really needs?
Mm-hmm.
And by playing around with the amount that I'm allowing PVs to get activated or inhibited, can I prevent the paradoxical effect, turn it into a simpler system? And does that mean now the mouse is going to be poorer at performing an attention switching task, for example?
Mm-hmm.
And do you look at the effects on neural activity only at the kind of large scale of all the neurons in general? Or do you look at like the neurons closer to those being optogenetically activated versus those further away?
So ultimately, what we would like to do is to record from tens of thousands of neurons across multiple parts of the brain while you perturb one part of the brain. Because really, the brain is, I mean, these regions of the brain are rarely acting in isolation. The brain is this intricately interconnected network across large distances, across
mm-hmm.
multiple brain regions. And so really what I would like to do would be to image across large, large regions of the brain, many, many areas, while perturbing one and then maybe perturbing the other. And this is something which actually is a great opportunity to segue into something else, which is another way in which people are pushing this ability of imaging
mm-hmm.
to be able to image multiple brain regions at the same time. And so rather than, so what we've been talking about so far is this two-photon imaging, and you're sort of zooming in and seeing individual neurons, but you're limited to, let's say, a millimeter square or something like that, or half a millimeter square, a millimeter square. What the sort of some really impressive designs of two-photon microscopy are now allowing exactly this idea that So typically when you want to look at larger area, you need to zoom out. And when you zoom out, you stop seeing further details. You stop seeing single neuron detail. You can't see individual neurons anymore. You can't see subcellular compartments. what you'd like to do would be to keep that resolution and still have imaging across large areas.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what people, some people would call mesoscopic imaging, different ones developed by different groups. Some of them have done these amazing feats of recording from large areas, again, quasi-simultaneously. The most, I think, I've heard, so there are some, I think about 5 or 6 years ago, which managed to record 10,000 neurons by doing this mesoscopic imaging. And a few years ago, there was a group which was able to create multiple beamlets, much like what we were discussing about creating multiple, but they created like up to like 30 beamlets or something like that, just staggered slightly in time so that you know which photon coming out was from which beamlet.
Mm-hmm.
So because ultimately you need to sort them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they did this incredible technique, and they were able to record up to 1 million neurons simultaneously.
Wow.
Right?
And this is with calcium indicators.
This is with calcium indicators.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you can. Then that's you could also start to imagine doing this with, you know, other kinds of dyes. There's also this. There's always been this a lot of interest in developing voltage sensitive dyes,
mm-hmm,
as an alternative to calcium imaging for one of the reasons which you brought up right at the beginning, which is to do with time.
Mm-hmm.
If you start using voltage sensitive dyes, they're much, much faster. They can actually resolve individual action potentials, but they're just not there yet. They're not bright enough. They bleach very quickly. They have other technical problems, which is why calcium is an alternative that's much more popular.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, the bottom line is that recording from large regions across the brain while still maintaining single neuron resolution is really where people are pushing now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something which I find really exciting, to be able to record from the prefrontal cortex and the visual cortex, and who knows, maybe even deeper structures like the striatum using other techniques. Like you can put,
mm-hmm,
you can implant something called a Grin lens, which is like a cylinder of glass, which allows you optical access to deeper regions in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you could record from deep structures, front of the brain, back of the brain, all of these things simultaneously, and people are already doing this. Some people are doing this using the approaches of just putting two microscopes onto the mouse. So you have one microscope looking at the back, one microscope looking at the front. But there are other approaches which are like really using these impressive technologies to be able to make your light reach further and further and just push the bounds of how widely you can record yet with high resolution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's amazing how much you can do with light in the brain nowadays.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So when you were looking at the activity of the VIP cells and how the initial hypothesis was that the increase in VIP cell was correlated to attentional modulation, what other function and what other brain state do you think that the activity in these VIP cells was having?
Yeah, that's a great question. So what are they doing if not attention?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so we actually speculate on this. There's a very bizarre phenomenon which happens in the mouse brain.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as we know, there's only one experiment which has tested this in a primate brain, and it doesn't happen there. And this is the following, that if you are looking at a stimulus and there's an electrode in your brain and you show a stimulus, you get a certain amount of activity evoked every time a visual stimulus appears, and you're recording from your visual cortex. In mice, if you do the same experiment, you get the same result. You show a visual stimulus, you get response in the visual cortex. If the mouse happens to start taking a few steps, essentially starts moving, starts walking or starts running, and you show exactly the same stimulus and you're recording from exactly the same neuron, the response is suddenly much, much larger, like massively larger. And you can even see this if you're doing these two-photon imaging experiments, and you're like showing various stimuli, and then suddenly the response is much brighter, and you're like, wow, what happened? It just turns out the mouse started walking a little bit. And in our case, of course, the mouse is walking on a running wheel placed under its feet. So this is something that was discovered a few years ago, that there's just by walking, by locomotion, causes responses to be much stronger in the visual cortex. Why is this happening, and why does the brain need to do this? What are the consequences of this? Absolutely no idea. I was talking to Tobias Bonhoeffer once, who's done a lot of studies on the visual cortex. And I asked him this question, why do you think this happens? And he says, I have no idea, but the only thing I know is that whenever I want to visualize something while I'm thinking about a scientific project, I have to walk while I'm thinking. So I'm like, okay, there you have it. Having said that, I don't think this is something that happens in humans, because the only person who does it in primates has seen there's no difference whether you're walking, whether you're moving or not moving. But there's this very bizarre effect that visual responses are stronger when an animal is walking. And it turns out that the VIPs do that enhancement.
Okay.
And that's something we confirmed,
okay,
again in this same study, that when we switch off VIPs, this enhancement becomes diminished. So you need the VIPs to cause this boost, locomotion-induced boost.
But maybe it's one-directional, because then the mice wouldn't stop walking, right? When you shut down.
Absolutely, yeah. It's absolutely, it's nothing to do with the walking.
Mm-hmm.
It's the walking has a side effect.
Yeah.
And that side effect passes through the VIP cells.
Yeah, cool.
But who knows what that induced, because I'm sure it's not like mice sit still and look.
Yeah.
And they move and they look, right? They don't.
They rarely sit still though.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I guess you're right. I mean, but you can, there are plenty of times where they're close to their burrow or in their burrow when they're sitting still, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
Or even when they're outside. I've seen some mice in my house who,
if they're really
pause.
Docile.
Yeah, that's true.
That's a perfect place to end the episode.
Yeah.
We'll end today's episode here. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing all of your knowledge about both all of the tools that are available, how they've developed, and how they can specifically be used to answer some very, very important questions.
Yes, it's been amazing. I feel like with everything that you say, like 10 more questions pop into my head, which I think is like the nature of science. The more clarification we have, the more questions we want to ask. And it's been really nice to listen into like the history of how things started, all the way to like the crazy future directions that are out there, which I'm really excited about. And yeah, I'm really excited to start using some more two-photon imaging in my experiments.
No, it's been a real pleasure. It's been real fun talking to both of you. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Oh, I'm glad.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Please feel free to follow us on our social media at neuroverse_pod and our website neuroversepod.com for all of our resources.
This episode is part of our mini-series, Tools for Looking into the Brain, which is sponsored by Scientifica, one of the leading producers of state-of-the-art electrophysiology and imaging tools. Scientifica supports researchers around the world to make advancements in neuroscience, cardiology, cancer research, and various other scientific areas. In addition to leading equipment and comprehensive support, Scientifica hosts an extensive resource center dedicated to fostering the sharing of expertise, which is full of a wide range of blogs, videos, case studies, and much more. Be sure to check out their website for more information and to find out more about the topics discussed in today's episode and about other tools for looking into the brain. Thank you again for listening.